You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP, Northampton 103.3, and streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. So this show, it aired on December 24th, but the recorder didn't work. So if you're listening online, this isn't the actual show that went live. This is my re-record. So this show is sort of a potluck hodgepodge show. I got a bunch of things thrown together that are maybe somewhat unrelated. There's a walk with my friend Ben Winter in the woods talking about some nature things. There's an interview with Alex Jarrett about the bike path phone system and the bike path bench behind our house in Florence. There's a recording of Amtrak coming to Northampton with some dignitaries on it on Monday to celebrate the return of passenger rail to Northampton. There's the Christmas story from Dwayne Rainey and a few other tidbits. We'll go first to the interview with Ben. And this is from a walk that we took in the Sawmill Hills Conservation Area, which is just a couple blocks from the radio station. It's just a few blocks from downtown Florence. Beautiful woods. If you ever want to take a walk, if you go down Pine Street after you cross the Mill River, go straight across Spring Street through the Chart Pack driveway, and then back in there are the Sawmill Hills. I'm sure you can see maps online, too. Here's Ben.
I said wintertime is a neat time to explore the woods on a mild winter day. There's still a lot going on the forest floor and on rocky outcroppings and stuff. You got moss and lichen all mixed together. I mean, there's different, a couple different species of lichen here. Some of them grow right on the face of the rock, and some of them seem to be growing like mixed in with the moss, so they're sort of puffier.
Some are gray, the same color as the rock.
Yeah, right on there. And then green. And I mean, everything's brightened up and softened up in this weather because it can actually grow and reproduce. Just some reproductive things sticking up on a bunch of these little mounds of lichen. Little cups. And then in the middle of the rock, there's like a low point in the rock where the leaves stick. And there's actually soil underneath the leaves that probably took, you know, decades to accumulate. Just from a few leaves breaking down.
Yeah, what about lichen?
I was going to say lichen are a good indicator of air quality. I grew up in the city, and the only lichen you ever see would be like from the branches at the very tops of the trees when they would fall out sometimes. But when you walk around the woods here, there's just like, you know, every tree is completely covered with lichen. Which is interesting because like when I learned to identify trees, it was in a city. Or the trunks of a tree is kind of like this pristine specimen of a certain, you know, species of tree. But out here you had to like decipher it underneath the like thick coating of lichen and moss.
Uh-huh. So how does the lichen respond to different kind of, like air pollution?
It just doesn't, you don't see it growing. And I mean it's like, it's usually at the lower levels in the cities, you know, maybe the first 20 or 30 feet. I think there's like more air pollution, you know, especially from auto exhaust concentrated at those levels. And just the lichen, because I'll have branches. It reminded me of it because here branches fall out of trees and they lay on the ground. The lichen still seem to grow fine. But I would, when a branch would lichen, it would fall from way up out of a tree where I grew up in the city. I would then like kind of put it on the back deck railing because it was pretty. And like after about 6 months to a year, the lichen would die. And I think it must have been because of the something in the air pollution. I don't know. I mean, the air wasn't like that polluted necessarily, but it couldn't live.
So the lower, so it really makes a difference how like the ground level smog, like it's really worse.
There's something in those
10 or 20 feet closest to the ground.
That first little bit of air where we all live.
Wish I was taller.
Yeah. Maybe humans will have to adapt that way. There's two chestnut oak trunks right next to each other. So these are probably stump sprouts. So this tree was once cut, I guess 75 or 80 years ago. And then these two sprouts came up from the trunk. And then they've made their own trees, but they're pretty scraggly. the location we are, like on this dry, rocky ridge, like a chestnut oak is like really happy. I mean, it just outcompetes the other trees up here. Yeah, it's kind of amazing to think how old the original root system might be. Because these trees really successfully resprout, so who knows how many times it was cut and then resprouted. I've seen old pictures of Sawmill Hills where they look kind of like, it looks like kind of like South Dakota. It was all like pasture land. Uh-huh. They had animals on it, so that would keep the trees down. But it may not be as true on these ridgetops. They may have left, you know, these things may have been sprouting. I mean, it may have been like a several decade long period where this trunk just kept sending up sprouts and somebody came by and cut the little tree down every few years to keep it open. And then it was allowed to grow back into a tree. It's hard to say, but it's, you know, it's possible that some of these root systems could be from the original forest. Mm-hmm. They're almost like thermometers. You can, when it's mild, you know, like this kind of weather over the next few days, they'll actually, the leaves will actually perk up and they can do some photosynthesis. And like when it gets cold, it's like when it's below freezing, the leaves will start to drop down. When it gets below like 15 or 20, the leaves will start curling up. And when it's near zero, the leaves will be like so curled up that you almost can't tell that there's leaves on it. You know, it's just like really trying to restrict the surface area. And then they'll open back up when it gets mild again. And it's just, you know, it's slow. Like you just notice it like one day from the next, depending on the temperature. But I mean, I have a rhododendron. I could see out my kitchen window, and you know, I mean, I look out it, and I'm like, "Oh, it's a cold morning," because I could see how tightly closed up the leaves are. And so that's pretty neat.
How much of the leaf curling up is related to the temperature, and how much is related to the humidity or dryness?
Yeah, it probably is more the dryness, because when the air gets that cold, the air is also like really devoid of any moisture or humidity. Like cold air holds a lot less water vapor. So even if you have 100% humidity at a low temperature, there's much less water in the air than, you know, like 100% humidity right now. So, uh-huh. Yeah, it is dry, I see. White pine is the great tree of New England. I mean, when Whitey came here, I mean, when the colonists came here, and at first, you know, I think there was like some amazing white pine trees and white pine forests, and those 200-foot tall white pines were like all claimed by the King of England for ship masts. That really is like one of the things that like helped England be like the naval power of the world in those centuries. There still are some of the great white pines still growing, and in Mohawk Trail State Forest in Massachusetts, right off Route 2. The tallest tree in New England. Yeah, I think there's a taller white pine in Pennsylvania, but there's a white pine in that forest that's, it's like 168 feet tall. And anyway, some these people who measure it say that it's still growing like 6 inches a year in height. So, you know, it's going to be the tallest tree in the East. Wow. Unless, you know, it gets hit by a storm. But it's in a pretty protected spot, a little valley, so. And it's in a grove of you know, dozens of large, similar height white pine trees. You could hear the wind way in the tops of the trees. White pines really, the way the winds blow, I mean, they're so tall and they have like such, they have large, you know, thick crowns of needles, but the way the wind blows through them, you know, especially in the wintertime is really, it's really a nice sound. Wind in the pines. I mean, most people would recognize it, but it's neat when you get out somewhere quiet and really just like, that's all you can hear. It's like the loudest noise.
How about the way that they drop their branches? It's
like, yeah, they tend to just lop off a whole big branch, generally from the bottom going up. When you're in this grove of old growth white pine, the branches are way up at the top. And the grove is just a really great place to sit. I went there on September 28th this year, and it was like a really good day for fall foliage up that way. It was a warm day, but a lot of the leaves would turn. So we were in this white pine grove, and you know, it's like really open because the trees are old and dominant, and there's not much understory, and there's pine needles, so it's really soft and quiet. But then, like just a few trees over, there was a birch tree whose leaves kept like blowing down, you know, yellow leaves kept blowing down in the wind through the sunlight.
And it was just like, it was like the most spectacular fall day. And, you know, that place just seemed, I mean, it really seemed like cathedral-like, you know, to be there. Like, it was a special spot.
That was Ben Winter talking about the woods. There are a lot of trees in Northampton that are special to me and to other people. There's one tree downtown. I was talking with someone who said that that tree is special to them because it's the same kind of tree that they grew up with, climbing and smelling the flowers of and dancing beneath in their homeland. And now, well, there was a disaster not too long ago in their home country. And so they would come to that tree every night to pray and meditate. Another tree that's special to me is the white pine tree in the backyard where I live. And the tree is special being a white pine tree, but it's also special because of some of the alterations that we've made around it. Here's Alex Jarrett to talk about a few of them. Alex, it's like a giant Christmas tree in our backyard. This white pine, it's a tree I love. And one of the really special things about it is the bike path phone that you've attached to it. Can you describe the bike path phone?
Well, it's just an old style landline phone that's sitting out here with a little handmade, not booth, but just a little shelter for the phone itself.
Out here on the bike path?
Yep, out here on the bike path in Florence.
Or the rail trail, sorry.
Multi-use path. and it's under a sort of a timber post and beam shelter. And it's you can call anywhere in the U.S. and Canada for free. And many people take advantage of that.
What else can the phone, can you do on the phone?
So there's all sorts of, there's a little plaque here that, that talks about all the different things you can call that aren't in the regular phone system. One of them is you can call the for the weather forecast, or if you want to know what time it is. You can call the monkeys, and maybe you'll have to do that too at some time on your show. and that's just you know, a bunch of screaming monkeys will come back at you.
And, so how is this phone wired? You pick up the receiver, then where does your voice go?
Well, there's a wire that goes back into the house, and then in the house there's a little device that converts the regular old, you know, analog landline phone signal into an internet signal, voice over IP, and then it goes over the internet to a server, and then eventually back to the regular phone system to complete the call wherever you need to go.
So something inside has to always be on, like the computer or something, or what has to be on to keep the system going?
Yeah, it takes some electricity, and but it's actually running about 8 phone lines, or it can run 8 phone lines. So it runs all the phone lines for our house and business and things like that too.
So the bike path phone system, can you explain that? Because isn't Pedal People on part on that in some way, the system that you've created?
Yeah, there's a lot of different businesses that just are part of the system. In 2006, that's when this bike path phone was installed. And I was just playing around with what you could do with computers and phones, and eventually realized that it made a lot of sense to run my own phone system. And then also I could help out other people like Valley Time Trade and the Valley Alliance of Worker Co-ops and places like that with just a simple voicemail and menu systems and things like that.
Well, I don't even know the questions to ask because this system is so boggling to me, but I just know that it's pretty amazing to have a phone out by the bike path. I know I use it quite a bit when I don't want to go inside and use the landline. Do other people use it?
Yeah, there's a lot of people. I think there's a lot of people who use it who they've run out of minutes on their cell phones, and or they don't have a cell phone or can't afford one, so they'll come here and use it. And then also it's just a nice place to sit and make phone calls. I guess most people, you know, who have cell phones can find lots of nice places to sit and make phone calls. But I guess it harkens back to days when there were payphones around, and it's not at all difficult to set up one of these things. Technically, it's more just, I guess, maintaining it. In the past, we had a lot of trouble with people vandalizing it. But at some point, I think we kind of realized that it was really just one person who was vandalizing it over and over. But that person has stopped. So this same phone has sat here for quite a while now. And
since 2006, you said, right?
No, but I mean this same physical phone, no one's tried to destroy it in a long time.
Like a couple years, or?
Yeah, this one might have been here for a couple years.
Sometimes the cord pops out and people will bring extra cords by.
Yeah.
Or do you get donations for the phone sometimes, or how do you pay for it?
Oh, well, there isn't much in the way of paying for it these days because it's run for free through Google Voice. International calls still cost money, so whenever we get a donation, sometimes people will give a donation, and they will then we'll put money on an account, which whenever someone makes a call, then it's drawn from that account.
So it says on the plaque here that you can create a free voicemail account.
Yes, that's part of the system too. If you want voicemail, which is then an extension off a public number, then you can go through the process here and do that. And you can check it from anywhere or online, too. You don't have to just do it from here.
Do you have to come to this physical phone to create a free voicemail account on this number?
No, actually, you can call an access number, which is 413-825-6795, and then just dial 99, and you will be able to create your own voicemail account if you want, without ever having to come to this particular phone.
Something else I like to use that number for, 825-6795, is to then dial extension 051 to get the Northampton weather forecast. So if someone calls out on this phone, they're sitting here on the bench or on the chair, and they call out, they call a friend on the cell phone, what number shows up on their friend's cell phone or on their friend's caller ID?
It's a number from Google Voice that comes up. And actually, they can call back, but I think the ringer is broken on this phone, so it will never ring. But if people call back and happen to pick up at the right moment, they can talk to someone. A lot of times people will send text messages back, like, "Who is this?" Or "I'm busy." And so the text messages obviously can't come to this phone, so I just see them as an email message. So that's interesting. And then sometimes people call back and leave voicemail messages, which are effectively public messages that anyone can check because it's entirely a public phone. So there's been some interesting messages that have been left there.
Can you think of any?
No, I mean, sometimes, just there's sort of a lot of sad things. It's just sort of like stories about people wanting to reach each other or having problems with each other or, hoping that there was someone who called them and they don't know how to get back in touch with them. And so they're hoping that, someone can connect them, but we don't really have any idea generally. Because they're just someone who stopped by here.
What if you call 911 from this phone? What happens?
It redirects you to 911, but it also will ring a phone in our house and say, "Someone is calling 911 from the bike path phone." And then, so we'll run out and see if there's an actual emergency so we can actually respond much sooner. But often it's people being pranky. So we sometimes we'll catch them and be like, "Why did you call 911? We know you did."
Yeah, it's usually children running away by the time they get out here. Once I saw a police officer on bicycle up here on the phone. He had come to check out where these 911 calls were coming from.
Yeah. So now they know.
Anything else you'd like to say about your motivations for putting this here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's... I'm just sad by the lack of payphones these days and how, you know, you have to have a cell phone often to be able to travel and, you know, be able to reach people, you know, be able to have a phone. And so I wanted to create an opportunity still for payphones to exist or non-payphones in this case. Unfortunately, it hasn't really taken off. I have on the website for it that I'll help anyone else set it up, but I don't know of anyone who's actually set one up, although some people have been excited about the idea.
What do you think's prohibitive about it?
I mean, you know, there's a certain amount of work in running a wire to a place on your property, but I think a lot of it is about a place on your property that anyone can, or that you're inviting people to come to and use a phone. And, you know, sometimes people get pretty rowdy out here having big arguments on the phone. And I mean, obviously they could do that anywhere if they have a cell phone. It's asking a lot of people to invite people into their space. I think in my experience, it's been, you know, vast majority of those experiences are good ones and meeting new people and having people be thankful for it. And then there's some people who will try to take things out on it. So that can be frustrating and sort of spoil it. But yeah, we haven't let it spoil it. It's been, you know, running for 8 years now.
Do you want to say anything more about the bench? Do you want to describe the bench a little bit that the phone is under? Or the roof, the bench area?
Sure. It's a cob bench. So that means it's made out of clay, sand, and straw. And then there's a base of old sidewalk pieces, concrete pieces that's, you know, actually put together with concrete. But then on top of that, the place you actually sit on is just made of those natural materials. And it's had many incarnations over the years. You know, originally we put like glass bottles embedded in it and a mirror, and those ended up getting broken. So we've kind of made a less destructible form. So it's got a lot of like things carved in it and such, and every few years we resurface the bench. And so last night actually someone gave me some hints about how to make the surface harder, which would be helpful.
And how do people know that this is a place that they're welcome to come be?
Well, there's a sign in many, many languages. Please seat yourself in English and Japanese and German, Urdu, and Spanish, and Hebrew, and French, and several others. So that hopefully people can get the idea that they should come sit down.
Have you had any problems with people being under the influence or causing trouble out here?
Sometimes we've had to ask people to be quiet or go move on. Sometimes I think it's annoyed the neighbors to have people here, but I think overall, you know, the positive outweighs any negative.
There's also a little mushroom toadstool looking bird bath over here. Do you want to say anything about that?
It's a memorial for a man who died over here. His family asked if they could put that up, and it's actually not technically on our property. It's the city's or National Grid property, but it's nice to have that there.
Is any of this on... Whose property is any of this on?
Well, it's sort of a mix of properties.
Let's leave it
at that.
That was Alex Jarrett talking about the bike path phone system in the backyard. Again, if you want to set up a free voicemail account through this system, just dial 413-825-6795. And if you want to check the weather in Northampton, the weather forecast, same number, but extension 051. Oh, I have another little tree story from Florence. So not too long ago, I was walking up the bike path to downtown Florence, and between my house and and Chestnut Street, I saw next to the path, like at the bottom of a slope where people throw their leaves, there was this plastic ficus tree in a pot, maybe 5 feet tall. And I thought, that's odd. Did someone throw it out with their leaves and not realize it was plastic? But anyway, stranger things have happened, so I kept on about my business. And then later that afternoon, I was home, and I was hanging out by the white pine, by the bike path, talking to my friend Dennis, and he had that tree there. And he said, yeah, I found this ficus tree. It was sitting up the path. And I thought, I'm going to take that home because that's a perfect match for the other plastic ficus tree I have in my apartment. And right then his friend Jace walked up, and Jace said, yeah, I was coming home from Cooper's Corner last night, and I saw it sitting by the dumpster out there by Cooper's. And I picked it up, and I thought, that'll look nice in my apartment. And so I started walking down the bike path with it, and I got partway down the path, and I was just noticing how pretty the trees and woods were, and I thought it would make a nice picture. And so I set the tree down, and I took a picture on my cell phone, and I texted it to my girlfriend and told her I was coming home with this tree, and she said, yeah, don't bring that thing home. And so I just left it right there. So that's as much as I know about that ficus tree. I don't know what happened, how it got to the dumpster at Cooper's Corner, or what happened next, but that's part of the story. So next we have some clips from Amtrak. So on Monday, an Amtrak train rolled into Northampton with the governor and some state legislators on board, and it picked up Mayor Narkowitz, and they went on to Greenfield. But first they stopped in Northampton and said a few things. The expandable brass band was there to welcome them, as well as about 100 people.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Governor shaking hands with all Patrick.
Hey everybody. Welcome to Northampton Station. We are really, really excited to have this inaugural train stop here. And really excited to have a special guest to help us christen this beautiful new station.
People. We got mayors, we have members of the legislature, we have city councilors, and we have a whole lot of excited citizens who have been waiting for a long time for the train to come back to Northampton, and it's back. I want to especially thank the members of the legislature who authorized the funds and the investments so that the state could do its part, and there are many members of our legislature here, and I thank them for that extraordinary partnership. Give them a round of applause. You're all great to come out today. In order for this line to be successful, you gotta use it. So ride the train. I'm saying that on behalf of Amtrak. This is the last unpaid endorsement I intend to give. After January 8th, it's going to cost you money. God bless you, everybody. Happy holidays.
So I made a cardboard sign to take to the event. Mostly I tucked it under my arm and just showed it to people who seemed interested because I didn't want to take away from the festive atmosphere. My sign says, "Thanks for the train. The fence is half up. Where's the tunnel?" And there's a map of the Bradford Street area and where the new fence goes that prevents crossing. And it says, "How will we get between King Street commercial centers and Industrial Drive jobs or Bradford Street homes? How will kids bike to Montessori school? How will rail trail users connect? North Street is a mile extra. And what about the other animals whose habitat is fragmented? Please put in the tunnel soon." And then there's a little rabbit down the corner saying, "All I want for Christmas is my two front teeth so I can chew through the fence." A couple of Amtrak officials just read my sign and they said, "It's coming, the tunnel's coming. The people have been trespassing for however many years." On my way back from the event, I went along the railroad tracks and I spoke to one of the workers that was installing the fence. He was clipping little things around the bottom where the chain links attach to a cable at the bottom. He was pretty optimistic. You think the rabbits will be able to dig underneath, all right?
A rabbit can dig a hole anywhere, so.
Good. They're going to continue the path all the way up to here and put a tunnel underneath.
Yeah, that's what they were saying. I mean, the tunnel shouldn't be too bad.
That probably won't be done until, I don't know, June. Yeah, so what people were saying is that when the ground thaws in the spring is when they expect to start construction on the tunnel and that hopefully it'll be done by June. Meanwhile, it's a little challenging for people to get across and the vital crossing point. I was picking up trash this morning on Woodmont Street and I overheard one neighbor say to another, "Hey, how do you like our new fence? I guess we won't be walking to the grocery store anymore." So that's kind of a bummer that it was just 100 feet to go across right there, but now you have to go a mile out of your way to get to the closest legal crossing. Next, I have a Christmas story as told by Dwayne Rainey.
In 1979, I was in Hawaii. I was stationed there in the 1st Marine Brigade fixing helicopters in Kaneohe Bay, Hawaii. And about a month after I got there, I messed up my left knee and I had to have surgery on my knee. So then my job in the military was to be a patient. So it was supposed to be about 3-4 months between a surgery and a rehabilitation and everything. And so that's my mother's oldest son, and she knew I had surgery, so how mother's, "Oh, you gotta call me, you gotta call me." So I'd call her 2 or 3 times a week just to say hi and let her know how my rehabilitation was going and then just be a patient. And she would always say, "So when are you gonna get the cast off? When are you gonna come home again?" I'm like, "You know, I'm gonna be in the hospital for about at least 3 months." She's like, "Oh, that's too bad." I was like, "Yeah." So talking to some of the other patients that were there at Triple Army Medical Center, one of them said, "Hey, you know, we get like 30 days free leave." I said, "30 days free leave? What do you mean?" He says, "Yeah, it's called convalescent leave. And we can have 30 days to convalesce, you know, just to heal. Instead of being here in a hospital, we can go someplace else." I was like, "Wow, that sounds like a great idea." And it was see, September, let's see, October. So this is around the end of November when somebody told me about this convalescent leave, and I was like, well, all right. So I would talk to my mother, say, hey, how are you doing? And, yeah, oh, therapy's going great. And so I started working on this. And it was getting into December, and I was starting to set things up, and still just saying hi to my mom a couple times a week. And so then I got down to where I got a flight from Hawaii to San Francisco, and then from San Francisco to Atlanta, then a flight from Atlanta to Bradley Airfield. And I set all that up and signed the papers, and I was on convalescent leave, so I'd called my mother, and I said, yeah, no, therapy's going great, and yep, the food's all right, you know, weather's still fine, yep, and okay, I'll call you in a couple of days. So after I hung up on the phone with her, I went to Honolulu airport and jumped on a plane. And so I flew all for, actually, I didn't jump on a plane. I went to Hickam Air Force Base, and I jumped on a C-130, which is like a slow frigate airplane. I said frigate, not frickin', but it's slow. And it took us 10 and a half hours with a tailwind to fly from Oahu into right around San Francisco. So then I got off there, took a bus down to San Francisco airport, and then I flew to Atlanta, and then from Atlanta to Bradley Field. I did this all within about 30 hours, I'd say. Okay. And I wasn't due to call my mother yet. So I got to Bradley, and I jumped on a Greyhound bus, and I came up, and buses used to go in through East Hampton. And so I got off in East Hampton because I was going to go see my cousin where he worked, and go stay with my aunt, her sister, for the weekend. And, you know, until Christmas Eve, and go surprises. Hey, guess what? So I saw my cousin, and he's like, wow, hey, you're good, you're back. He says, well, I got a bottle of 101 proof spearmint snaps. I'm like, all right. He says, so we made plans to get together that night and cruise around. And I said, you got to be, can't tell anybody because I'm here. But he said, yeah, no problem. So I went to my aunt's house, and she was pretty surprised. And so we were sitting around having a couple of drinks. And she said, oh, I'd love to have you here, but me and my boyfriend have been trying to, like, spend a weekend together, and something's always coming up, and this weekend we were going to, like, spend together. I said, ugh. All right, so I said, let me call my mother. So I call my mother, and my mother's on the phone, and my family drank a lot, so she's had her Yuletide buzz going, and a couple of days before Christmas, she's like, oh, hi, honey. And I says, hi. How's everything? How's your therapy? I said, therapy's wonderful. And she goes, wow, we have such a good connection. She says, you sound like you're so close. I'm like, well, there must not be any storms at sea interrupting, you know, the cables going from, you know, under the ocean and to Hawaii. And she's like, oh, okay. So do you know when you'll be coming home? I said, well, maybe around your birthday in February. She's like, oh, that's so great. And I said, all right, well, gotta go. And I hung up in a minute. And while I was doing this, my aunt was making all these faces trying to get me to blow my cover. She's sticking her tongue out, making, you know, just really, really goofy faces. And I held it together. And after I hung up the phone, I said, what are you trying to do? Just trying to make me blow this? I've just come all this way. And you're trying to just blow my cover. She goes, oh, I'm sorry. I says, yeah. So a minute later, the phone rang, and it was my mother calling her sister. saying, oh, Dwayne just called and he said he might be home for my birthday and, oh, that's just so great and blah, blah, blah. And so my aunt said to her, she says, yeah, you know, I know we don't get each other presents or anything. We never have. But I was walking through the mall the other day with my boyfriend, Artie, and I saw something that I just knew you would love. She says, and we're going to be over in about maybe half an hour. And I'll just drop it off. Nothing big. Don't worry about it. Don't give me no present. So now we drove over to my house. And I was just sitting in the car. So I was sitting in the car and not really, you know, I was pretty excited that I was going to be, my mother thought I was in Hawaii and I was in our driveway now. And so this guy already come out about 10 minutes later. He says, yeah, come on in. So I snuck in the back door. I was standing there in our entryway, and Artie's like, hey, Don, can you help me? This is pretty heavy. And my mother's like, what? What do you mean, pretty heavy? And she rounded the little corner there and seen me and just started jumping up and down and running in place and crying and screaming. And then I was like, Mom, you got to settle down or you're going to have a heart attack. And my youngest brother, who had answered the phone, he's just like, what? How did you just call me from Hawaii and now you're here? And so that was great. So after we got done having a few drinks and whatever, my cousin called me and me and my cousin went out for the night. And I helped him to polish off this bottle of spearmint snaps. And so I ended up staying or passing out at his house, which is like right across the field. We lived out on Sylvester Road. And so my mother, being all excited, we used to take and write notes and put them on a kitchen table for everyone to see when they'd come in from wherever they had come in from. And my mother just wrote this note and put it on the table and said, Dwayne's home. And that's all it said. Well, another one of my brothers, I have two, he was working from like 3 to 11 at the state hospital. So he come home and he looked down the table, he seen a note, said, Dwayne's home. So he went down to our bedroom and looked, and I was in the top bunk. He's like, oh, that's it. Mom's really losing it. She's all drunk, and now she's just thinking my brother's home. Well, okay, whatever. So he went to bed. My father come home about 2:30 in the morning. He was a truck driver, and he sees a note. And he goes down to the bedroom and looks in and says, yep, she's drunk and she's losing it, they're thinking. So they're about ready to have her kind of committed, sort of. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, she's really lost it. Until they both see me the next day and they're like, oh, whew, we are so relieved. And I'm like, what do you mean? Yeah, we thought Mom was really losing it. She was just saying Dwayne's home. And she got up in the morning and saying, he's home, he's home. And she says, we couldn't find you. And then I explained that I stayed next door. But that happened to be the last Christmas, I think, pretty much, that my whole family, as a family, ever spent together. So that's probably my fondest Christmas memory that I ever have. And it wasn't about money, and it wasn't about buying things or anything. It was just doing something nice for someone else.
At the end of Dwayne's story, I was supposed to play Home Sweet Home by Motley Crue, but I played it on the radio, but I'm not sure how to play it in the online version. I'd like to take a minute now to think about people whose movements are restricted by others, whether it's Hampshire County Jail, Fifth Floors, Ludlow, Walpole, Guantanamo, or in people's own homes. The Massachusetts Bail Fund Project is a project to try and get people more aware of how the requirement for bail affects people disproportionately. Often people stay in jail for days, weeks, months, just because they can't afford to pay bail, often on minor charges. And that can be really destructive to their relationships, their housing, their employment, their health. It also makes it harder when you go to court and you're locked up and you go to court in handcuffs. You're more likely to get a heavier sentence, a longer sentence, than if you are able to come to court in street clothes. The Massachusetts Bail Fund Project, they can always use volunteers or money. The Criminal Justice Policy Coalition is an organization that's working on this. They're actually based in Cambridge, but they're doing work that affects the laws statewide. And their website is cjpc.org, the Criminal Justice Policy Coalition. Now, there's one more thing here I have that I wanted to read. This is actually an article from the New York Times from December 19th called Bring on the Dark, Why We Need the Winter Solstice. And it's written by Clark Strand, Woodstock, New York. When the people of this small mountain town got their first dose of electrical lighting in late 1924, they were appalled. Old people swore that reading or living by so fierce a light was impossible, wrote the local historian Alf Evers. That much light invited comparisons. It was an advertisement for the new, the rich, and the beautiful, a verdict against the old, the ordinary, and the poor. As Christmas approached, a protest was staged on the village green to decry the evils of modern light. Woodstock has always been a small place with a big mouth where cultural issues are concerned, but in this case, the protest didn't amount to much. Here, as elsewhere in early 20th century America, the reluctance to embrace brighter nights was a brief and half-hearted affair. December 20th is the winter solstice, the longest night of the year, but few of us will turn off the lights long enough to notice. There's no getting away from the light. There are fluorescent lights and halogen lights, stadium lights, street lights, stop lights, headlights, and billboard lights. There are night lights to stand sentinel in hallways, and the lit screens of cell phones to feed our addiction to information, even in the middle of the night. No wonder we have trouble sleeping. The lights are always on. In the modern world, petroleum may drive our engines, but our consciousness is driven by light. And what it drives us to is excess in every imaginable form. Beginning in the late 19th century, the availability of cheap, effective lighting extended the range of waking human consciousness, effectively adding more hours onto the day, for work, for entertainment, for discovery, for consumption, for every activity except sleep, that nightly act of renunciation. Darkness was the only power that has ever put the human agenda on hold. In centuries past, the hours of darkness were time when no productive work could be done, which is to say, at night, the human impulse to remake the world in our own image so that it served us, so that we could almost believe the world and its resources existed for us alone, was suspended. The night was the natural corrective to that most persistent of all illusions, that human progress is the reason for the world. Advances in science, industry, medicine, and nearly every other area of human enterprise resulted from the influx of light. The only casualty was darkness, a thing of seemingly little value. But that was only because we had forgotten what darkness was for. In times past, people took to their beds at nightfall, but not merely to sleep. They touched one another, told stories, and with so much night to work with, woke in the middle of it to a darkness so luxurious it teased visions from the mind and divine visitations that helped to guide their course through life. Now that deeper darkness has turned against us, the hour of the wolf, we call it, that predatory insomnia that makes billions for Big Pharma. It was once the hour of God. There is, of course, no need to fear the dark, much less prevail over it. Not that we could. Look up in the sky on a starry night, if you can still find one, and you will see that there is a lot of darkness in the universe. There is so much of it, in fact, that it simply has to be the foundation of all that is. The stars are an anomaly in the face of it, the planets, an accident. Is it evil or indifferent? I don't think so. Our lives begin in the womb and end in the tomb. It's dark on either side. We've rolled back the night so far that soon we will come full circle and reach the dawn of the following day. And where will that leave us? In a world with no God and no wolf either? only unrelenting commerce and consumption, information and media and light. We need a rest from ourselves that only a night like the winter solstice can give us. And the earth, too, needs that rest. The only thing I can hope for is that if we won't come to our senses and search for the darkness, on nights like these, the darkness will come looking for us. That was by Clark Strand, who is the author of the forthcoming book, Waking Up to the Dark, Ancient Wisdom for a Sleepless Age. That does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. If you'd been listening live, there'd be a few more songs. 25 de diciembre, boom, boom, boom. That one, and this is my song, a song for all the nations. This has been Out There. Tune in again sometime, usually on WXOJ, Valley Free Radio, 103.3 FM in Northampton, streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. Thank you.